It's been a while since you put me on the shelf. I know you've been distracted by somebody else. It's been a while, but that's all right, you see. And I'll be right here waiting when you want to play again with me.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the latest episode of Cult of the Old. I and my fellow human, definitely human, co-hosts, Nate and Ian are here. How you doing, guys?
I'm very good. Matt, how's yourself?
I'm very good. Definitely human last time I checked. What about you, Nate?
I'm definitely human too. Not so sure about Ian, though.
Womp womp.
Each episode, I and my fellow hosts are going to dive into the tabletop gaming past. We are going to turn back the release schedule at least 10 years and look at games that were setting tables ablaze in a dim and distant past of a whole decade ago. In our previous season, we covered games that were available either in physical form or in illegal digital means. This season, we're throwing that rule out so we can cover a wider range of games that we nonetheless think are important to talk about. And this is one of them. Where we can point you towards ways to play the games that we are covering, we will do so. So, without further ado, if you haven't guessed already, what are we looking at this cast? Well, the history of TV and film franchises becoming tabletop games has not been one filled with glory. Eager executives and overconfident designers would rush games out to market only to be met with a distinct sound of disinterested meh from the gaming public. Despite a few honourable exceptions like Star Wars Queen's Gambit and Epic Duels, when our next game came to market, everyone thought it would continue this run of duds. It didn't. Released 4 years after the start of the TV series it was based on, this sci-fi board game saw players engaging in inevitable betrayals and cunning tactics to win the game for their side. This game of artificial intelligence versus humans is not only on the nose with the current political climate, but, like its parent show, linked to the politics of its time through metaphorical allusions to 9/11. But it was a game we wanted to revisit, mostly for its cool mechanisms, its impact on design, and the realisation that franchise board games didn't need to be bad. Welcome aboard the Battlestar Galactica. Okay, guys, which of you two would like to give me a one-minute breakdown, which I'd like to remind our listeners is unrehearsed for this game?
I think it's my turn since Nate did it last time, and you're hosting. Okay. So,
well, and
I played it most recently out of three of us. I've got a timer.
Right, well, you can't time yourself. No.
No, that's fair.
I'm in the chair today. I'm timing you.
So, fair enough.
Let me just get a minute set up. You can, gargle and spit rinse, or whatever you need to do. Ready, steady. You're still spit rinsing for viewers, people who can't see this. Go.
In the Battlestar Galactica board game, players take on the roles of one of the titular characters of the TV series. But what the most important thing is at the start of the game, you are dealt out a loyalty card. This may mean that you are a lovely, lovely human or a terrible, terrible Cylon, a sort of robot that has taken on human form. And over the course of the game, the humans are trying to get to... what's the place called? Caprica?
Cobol,
thank you. The humans are trying to jump the ship several times, jump it through a sort of a light speedy kind of thing in the show to get to Cobol, and the Cylons are trying to ruin that effort. They're trying to make sure that the humans don't get there, either through reducing their population to zero or getting rid of all their food or all their water or all their fuel in some way or form. And the main way this is done is through crisis cards, where everyone sort of votes on little things to do. They put in skill cards to do, and Cylons can muck things up.
That's time. I'm sorry. Oh. We'll have to cut that one short. You can't.
That wasn't great.
The rules. we have a minute, and I put it on pause for when you were coughing as well.
That's right.
We live in a society. If you go take too long in the explanation, everything breaks down.
Would you like
obviously
to
Cylon. No, that's right.
Okay. So, I think
rules are rules.
We'll start this this episode by just reminding everybody that actually this is not the first Battlestar Galactica board game. The one that we're talking about, it's a 2008 game, and there were previous iterations in 1978 and 1984, and a 2006 collectible card game, all of which were pretty pants, as far as I'm aware. I don't think I've played any of them, have you guys?
No.
They don't have the most shining reputation, especially not compared to this one. So this was 2008, which I think was the year the final season of the show released. There were rumours that it was supposed to go on longer, but it got hit badly by the writer's strike that happened in late 2007 and ran through into 2009. And I think the hype of that final season coming out, because it was a popular show, right? Yeah.
There was, yeah.
It was, yeah, it was never more than like a cult hit, but this is in the days before streaming. So yeah. It was when big serialized TV shows were just starting to get a really take off. And before that had been taken over by what in the US were like basic cable shows. So yeah. This was a basic cable show, but it was the same era as like Lost was a really similar kind of show that had. That was on a major network as opposed to this one. So, but yeah, it had a strong cult following. It was, especially for people who had liked a lot of Star Trek shows like DS9, and in fact had a lot of the same writing staff as Deep Space Nine.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Ronald D. Moore. Same. Yeah.
Ah.
The hype of the final season, I think, contributed towards the launch of the game, or its popularity at launch. It was designed by Corey Kneska, a name pretty well known now in design circles for Fantasy Flight games, but it looks like this was his first major title flying solo. He had a number of co-credits beforehand, but this was his first game in which he had the only name on the box, and it's obviously a big one. To get out, the publisher, obviously, I've just said, was Fantasy Flight Games, and there were a large number of artists on the, or not artists as such, but there was a lot of stills from the show in terms of the art, but the credited artists on the box were Kevin Childress, Brian Schoenberg, and Will Springer. Doesn't have that many awards, especially given its given its vaunted reputation, but it was nominated for the Asdor Game of the Year in 2010. Guys, how did you first come across Battlestar Galactica, the game?
Well, for my sins, I worked for His Master's Voice, or HMV, in the UK, which was a sort of big sort of DVD, CDs, records, things like that kind of shop in the UK. And they had some US and Canada stores as well. But I worked for HMV for many, many years. And at one point, they started to go into more sort of like franchisey kind of toys, games, things like that. And this was one of the games that the company bought in at one Christmas. And I wish I'd bought a lot of copies on the cheap, because I could have made a lot of money in the long run. But I only bought myself one at the time. And I played it a good bit. It was good fun. I didn't quite gel my group, but I really liked it. And I picked up just because I was sort of curious, because Fantasy Flight games were kind of on the ascendance at the time. I'd played some of my first board game purchases were things like Thunder's Edge, if you remember that from Fantasy Flight Games, way, way back in the early days. So like that was some of my first early board game purchases. So yeah, it was a game I picked up and yeah, kind of enjoyed. Yeah, just sort of managed to get, I got it pretty cheap though, because I basically got close to trade prices working for HMV.
Were you a fan of the show?
Yeah. I'm not sure if I'd watched the show before I picked up the board game, to be honest though. I can't remember. I might have watched the board show after I picked up the board game. It's entirely possible. Okay. Not sure. Can't remember.
Nate?
Yeah, my I have a long history with this game, actually. I played it at local game store. There was a copy there, and I played it, really enjoyed it. I had not watched the show yet at the time, and I liked it so much, I went out and bought my own copy, and then proceeded with my wife to watch the whole show on Netflix back when they had DVD rentals. They'd send DVDs in the mail, and we watched the whole show that way. And however long it took us, 6 months or so, I must have played that show or played that game so many times. I think in the final reckoning was probably over 50 times I played it in about 2 or 3 years. Oof. Which is just an unbelievable clip to go at with a game like this. And then for about the next, really, I think after the expansions came out, because Matt, I don't know if you mentioned this, but there were three expansions. There was a Pegasus expansion, Exodus, and then Daybreak were the three expansions they released for it. And as those came out, the game just got less and less play. Also, as the show kind of had wrapped up, had faded from consciousness, fewer people were kind of interested in it. The license didn't hold as much water as it used to. And then after about another 5 years or so, it had kind of played out for me, and I ended up purging it, probably not for very much, but my copy was really beat up. It had been very well loved. And it's one of those games that got just less and less compelling for me every time I revisited it. But when it burned for me, it burned real brightly. I would have said it was probably my favorite game for a good 2 or 3 years there.
So thanks for mentioning the expansions there, just showing my lack of professionalism and experience in introducing the show. So 3 expansions, Pegasus, Exodus, and Daybreak. One of the reasons I didn't mention them is because I had never played any of them.
Neither have I. No, I've only played the base game.
Oh, am I the only... I've never played Daybreak, but I played the first two.
Yeah, I think you might be the only one out of the 3 of us that's played any of those. We'll get to those, I guess.
Yeah.
No, I didn't. I've not played with them. I didn't watch the TV show. I have never watched the TV show, even after playing the game. I picked it up essentially because of the buzz around it, and I really like hidden information games and hidden rail games, you know, bluffing games, things like that. And I don't think at the time, certainly when this came out, they were kind of out of favor and there weren't that many of them around. So I was really quite excited to try it. And I bought it, tried it as a solo game, in actual fact. I don't think it's ever talked about as a solo game, but you there are solo rules in the back of the rule book.
Oh, wow.
And it's not unfun. It's not unfun as a solo game, but just a way to learn the mechanics. And then when I got that down, I took it to my local gaming club, and we were kind of pretty hooked, actually. It went down really well. Played it several times, but we really struggled for time. And this is a 3 to 4 hour game, and trying to fit that in a weeknight is difficult. Yeah. But we soldiered on nevertheless. And it kind of essentially, I played it a couple of times with friends as well, but it's just that playtime and the fact that it kind of really had to then... and kind of still does now, we'll touch on this later, need to be played face-to-face, have made the times that it's surface limited, but it's always an occasion when I do manage to get it to the table. Given that we've just talked about it being sort of, or I've just talked about it being a bluffing game in a time when there weren't that many bluffing stroke hidden role games around, what do we think there were influences on Corey de Kineska in designing this game? Where do you think he got his ideas from?
I mean, I guess the big stuff is sort of like early sort of werewolf mafia style games, right? Where like that sort of trait or mechanic is the core of the game. I mean, FFG's producer, I mean, they did some cooperative stuff, obviously, like Arkham Horror 2nd Edition was previous to Battlestar Galactica. Don't think they'd done much else other than that co-op-wise at the time. I'm trying to remember.
Not at that point, I don't think. But this was also at the point when Fantasy Flight was starting to get a number of interesting licenses.
Yeah.
Because you'll recall this, that the year before this, they released a StarCraft game.
Yeah,
that was actually, I only played it once, but I remember thinking it was quite good. Also,
yeah, I played it. It's pretty good. Yeah.
Had Corey Kineska on it as one of the co-designers, I believe, on that one.
Yep.
And they had the Game of Thrones game that Christian T. Peterson had designed. And so this is before the show had come out. So that was just kind of, you know, so they'd kind of made their, they were starting to make their bread and butter with kind of cult nerdy licenses like that, aside from licensed or aside from distribution deals they had for like War of the Ring and Kenichi's Lord of the Rings and stuff like that. So they were kind of making a name for themselves as a licensing company that was able to do that, those licenses justice.
I don't think Fantasy Flight ever had War of the Ring. They had the Lord of the Rings license.
They had the license for it. Yeah, they were. My first, I've owned that game twice now. But yeah, from the first English language distribution was through Fantasy Flight.
I didn't know that.
So they were a distributor, really, I think.
It was not an in-house design.
Ah, right, yeah. Okay. Oh, interesting. I did not know that.
At the time, there were a lot of comparisons with Shadows of the Camelot. Over Camelot, which was pretty popular. And I think it's probably fair to say that game had reinvigorated the mafia stroke werewolf style of game, which had been kicking around, you know, in the form of mafia style werewolf, but had kind of gone out of favor. But the key thing is that Shadows Over Camelot tried to put a little bit of mechanical stuff around the guessing out of the traitor. To make it more popular. But I did look around to see if Corey Kineska had ever really commented on the design or his thoughts, his inspirations on Battlestar Galactica. And the thing that really struck me is that every time he was asked this question, he went back to the TV show. So like, here's a quote I pulled out. He said, all of us here at Fantasy Flight are huge fans of the show. When our business department picked up the license, I was ecstatic and begged to work on the project. Christian T. Peterson and I sat down and fleshed out some ideas for the game, such as the cooperative with Cylon traitor mechanic. From there, I used the show's inspiration to create fiction extra conditions and flesh out all of the components. And I found this kind of interesting because I don't know how much of that is marketing speak, in the sense that he obviously wanted people, you know, to give the show credit. Yeah. He wanted to remind people that this was based on a hit TV show, and there may have even been some licensing considerations there, I don't know. But he never talked about any of the mechanical inspirations behind the game. And I just kind of find that interesting. I wonder if it's partly osmosis, because Shadow of the Camelot was big at the time, and partly just kind of like pride in his first big design. I don't know.
You know, one game we haven't mentioned yet is Betrayal at House on the Hill. And Betrayal at House on the Hill is especially interesting. I have no idea. It came out 5 years before and I think was actually out of print when Battlestar Galactica came out. It was in the wilderness for a while. Hmm. But Betrayal had this feature where you would read the little scenario book. And then you would open it up and it would say like, okay, when the haunt happens, when this thing happens, then someone becomes the traitor. And you kind of find out you're the traitor partway through the game, which is really unusual for this style of game. In Shadows Over Camelot, you knew you were the traitor from the beginning, some werewolf or mafia, something like that. You know from the outset, but this was the kind of thing where you didn't realize you were. And that's a huge part of the tension that goes into Battlestar Galactica. I don't know if that was an influence, but it certainly was an antecedent.
It's an interesting observation, that, actually, because I'd thought about Betrayal and I'd kind of dismissed it, because the key difference is that in Betrayal, it's arbitrary. So you fit a set of criteria. The person that triggered the haunt is now the traitor. So you have no input into it. You're not a traitor, and then you suddenly are a traitor. It's not hidden at all. You know, you're not suddenly revealed to cause chaos. But the partway through the game thing, in the same way that you can get a second Cylon card partway through Battlestar Galactica, is an interesting comparison, definitely. Given the fact that we had, like, you know, Shadows of the Camelot, Betrayal, House of the Hill, and then along came Battlestar Galactica with all this new shiny stuff to reinvigorate the genre, what kind of impact do you remember it having amongst gamers and gaming groups and the wider hobby at the time?
I think the biggest thing at the time was people going, oh, wait, licensed games don't have to be terrible. Because up to that point, like, let's face it, most sort of like film tie-in games, I mean, and we mentioned a couple of like previous Battlestar Galactica versions in the intro, were kind of rubbish. They were just like sort of spat out by like marketing departments and were just a bit terrible. And then Battlestar Galactica came along and it was like, actually, this is a good, solid game in its own right, quite divorced from the show. It's actually good. As someone's actually like, and it actually evokes the show pretty well. Like, it does a good job of its theme, it does a good job of mechanics, it was relatively affordable, it wasn't like crazy expensive or anything, and it was relatively available as well. So like it was available in HMVs and Morrison's and places like that in the UK, so it was all over the place, and it was like, it was actually, you know, good, which was a surprise.
I actually think that Battlestar Galactica came out at the absolute perfect time, the board game, that is. I think if it had come out 5 years later, it would not have had nearly the impact. And just game design in general just was not probably sophisticated enough to support it 5 years earlier. But right when it came out, 2008, that was really when I think a lot of pop culture was starting to really reckon with 9/11. And you mentioned that earlier, Matt, but I don't think you can underestimate that, especially in the U.S. at the time. I can't speak how things were in the U.K., but just in the U.S., the sort of the war on terror, the war in Iraq, this is all kind of tying back. And so much pop culture at the time, including the show Battlestar Galactica, was kind of reckoning with the emotional. It was the first time people were really starting to have conversations about that, about, you know, how about suspicion and how people can be, you know, is what are we willing to do in the name of security and things like that? And this is touched on all over the place at the time. Lost touched on it a lot, actually. I'm a big fan of that show. So that was a big thing. Then The Dark Knight came out. This just around the time this game did. And that movie might as well be about the war on terror. It pretty much is. And so there was really this perfect time, and combined with this idea of serialized TV really taking off, and not just serialized TV, but also like the daily blogging about it, which was this thing that happened for about 5 or 6 years until maybe 2013, 2014 or so, where you had shows that would just have weekly recaps of whatever TV show was on the air. and sites like the AV Club, Television Without Pity. And so Battlestar Galactica was able, it had a big cult following going into the game. And there's a huge overlap between people who like the show and people who are into hobby board games. So it came out at the perfect time when people were still really high on the show. The show had kind of, it ended fine, but the ending was kind of a people, you know, one of those endings that people are like, yeah. But after it ended, the kind of the furor died down. The show, it hasn't had a second life the way something like Breaking Bad has. Yeah. And so it's not, and so that's kind of meant that 5 years later, it wasn't going to be the big hit. What I remember about the game itself, that's just the cultural context, but the game itself, it was the first time I remember there being a lot of overlap between the camp of Euro games and the camp of like American Ameritrash style games, and where that kind of really, I noticed, started to collapse. And in fact, personally for me, that was what actually brought me over to the site Fortress Ameritrash, was talking about this game, which is how Matt and I got connected. And this is, so there's a lot of history here with this.
Sure.
But a lot of people who would only ever play something like Kalis or Princes of Florence or Puerto Rico, they were suddenly perfectly happy to engage with this game, which was seemingly antithetical to everything they wanted in a game. It was longer. It's at least a 3-hour game, especially if you're learning. It's got a lot of rules. It's got a decent amount of complexity, but it really reminded them really well of the show and really hit not just on the characters and the set and the dressings of the show, but like the themes and the emotions that the show generated, which is a really neat trick. And so I kind of mark this game as the time when the hobby started, when that blending of styles really became like overt, because a lot of those big Ameritrash games, there was the cult that really liked them on Board Game Geek, but now these were like suddenly starting to come into the top 10 and stuff like that. And I know we don't want to talk too much about jockeying for position on the Board Game Geek top 100, but you can see how trends kind of happen on that. And this was one of those games, I think, really kind of collapsed the hobby that way.
Yeah, I think there's I was going to say something similar. The weird thing about Battlestar Galactica that I remember is that it was everywhere very quickly. It's like this game came out and then suddenly everyone's talking about it, everyone's playing it. And partly that's because of the stuff that you've already mentioned. You know, it was easily available, relatively cheap, and it had the boost from the fact that it was based on a TV show. But you've absolutely got it there, Nate, in saying it's a game that bridges divides. Because really it's a game of two halves. The standard Fantasy Flight fan base, if you like, could have enjoyed the tension, the lack of the hidden information, which serves as randomness. I mean, there's dice rolls in this game as well, but of course, you know, so there's the dice, the excitement of the randomness, the role playing and the narrative. But at the same time, that I don't think when you play it for the first couple of times, it's really clear quite how strategically or tactically compelling skill checks or analyzing skill checks can be. That's something I only realized when I played the game by forum, which is something that became popular a few years later, because you can't, you know, it's a 3-4 again, can't get the table very easily, but very popular. So people started having a games master and playing it online, playing it by forum. And when you play it by forum, you can really see this creeping through, because those Kalis players that you're talking about will literally go back over all the messages and go, right, this player over the course of the game has played this many red skill cards, this many blue skill, this, so they must have contributed. And finally, they'll pin down one card. Oh, now that's out of character. That's against that skill check. This player must be a Cylon, you know, and actually figure it out or try and figure it out the way. So there is that really quite heavily analytical element there for players who like that kind of thing to enjoy. So yeah, it really did bring two churches together. I wouldn't say it was the first game that did that. I think that might actually be War of the Ring, which we've gone back to.
But possibly.
War of the Ring was more heavily on the thematic side, if you like. This was and it's probably even longer than 3 to 4 hours. I don't know. It's been long since I played War of the Ring, actually.
It's about there. About three or four. Yeah.
I've never played it, that's my understanding, yeah.
Yeah, a more accessible, sort of like more widely ranging title. And I think, just want to go back to say, because I found this, I think playing Battlestar Galactica or reading about Battlestar Galactica was the first time I realised just what an enormous disconnect there was in the cultural psyche between Britain and America about 9/11. Because by the time this came out in 2008, I think British, we hadn't forgotten about it, but it certainly wasn't something that was given any credence or thought in our national media, you know. or news or TV wise, and yet the fact, the way Americans talked about this game and its rep and the show and its relations to 9/11 really made me realise just quite what a scar that was, you know, in terms of American history. And it's something, I guess, that unless you've experienced, not firsthand, obviously, but unless you've lived in a country experiencing something like that, you probably can't really get to grips with what that does to your perception of your place in the world, I guess.
Yeah. And it's not just, I mean, it wasn't just the event, it was all the fallout afterward too. It's the, you know, it's the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, the really the George W. Bush administration, even going into the Obama administration. There's just a lot of, you know, we still, you know, and, you know, there's the tale of big events like that is always a lot longer than we think it is. But it's also worth remembering that Battlestar Galactica, the show, started in 2004. So it was a lot more recent when the show came out, and still kind of a very, like, a lot of the story had not even been written yet at that point. And by the time movies were coming out, they'd been in process for like 3 or 4 years at that point. And so I think that's why it was kind of happening at this point. But it's just interesting that it started showing up into media as like part of storytelling, as opposed to just like a political football at this point. And that's, yeah, it's really interesting. Someone's going to write a book about that someday. Not me though. Yeah,
I think the first time I remember going like, whoa, they've like gone there with like references to 9/11 was like, do you remember the series Fringe?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So like Fringe is like sort of like X-Files, but like the good early days of X-Files, and kind of managed to maintain that for its run, apart from maybe the last season, which was a bit dodgy. But like, at some point, there's like revealed to be like this spoilers for a show that's now like 20 years old. There's like this alternate world, alternate Earth, and the reveal of that alternate Earth was like someone basically standing in the two towers after 9/11 happened. Like, I can't remember when that show came out, like 2009, something like that.
It was around the same time, 2008.
Yeah,
it around 2008. The same time. Yeah.
And I remember that being the first time I went, whoa, wow, they've like gone there and done that. That's quite bold. Yeah.
I've never seen the show, and now it's been completely ruined for me. Completely.
Just the
ruined.
First season.
Thank you.
Fine.
Thank you, Ian.
You're
Fringe
fine.
Is great. Watch Fringe.
It's yeah, good. It is good. It's good.
I'm guessing from these conversations and others we've had over the course of the year that Nate may have watched more TV than I do.
maybe.
I've certainly never seen it. Never even heard of that one. No, not so. But I think it's, I'm going to spin this one out a little bit actually, because it just occurred to me as you guys were talking about it. It's kind of interesting because if you said about the show coming out in 2004 and when the memories and the unfurling or the aftershocks of 9/11 were still very fresh in America. And it's interesting to me that that was fine and that was considered, you know, an interesting piece of cultural commentary. But if somebody made a game that referenced 9/11 in 2004, I think the response to that would have been very different. Instead of it coming out in 2008. It's funny this, how people have this perception that games, even because games don't have to be light and funny. There's this perception that we have in of the attachment to the word game, you know, this context of the word game, that it's something fun, frivolous. And it doesn't have to be like that. But that context really can weigh down attempts that games, particularly video games, but also board games, have to tackle more serious subjects, do you think?
Well, you know, the game we can look to is Labyrinth, The War on Terror.
Yeah, I was
when that
say,
came out, that was 2010.
Twilight Struggle episode, right?
Right, yeah. Right. That came out in 2010. And I know you've played it, Matt. I have not, but that actually did. I mean, I don't know how much back and forth there was about it, but there were people who were like, "Boy, this is like when you hear about it on the P500." And of course, it's a P500, so it was announced like what, 3 years before it came out, yeah. And I remember there being some debate about it at the time. I think generally the game is regarded as broadly pretty respectful, but war games always have that tension, and we have talked about that before.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think games can handle more serious subject matters, but there's not been a huge number of attempts to do it. I mean, I remember playing a demo of Holding On, The Troubled Life of Billy Kerr, which was, it was a good few years ago now. And like, basically the idea of that game is you're sort of putting together the memories of a dying man. And it's got, it's an odd thing. I mean, I haven't played the full game, so I can't really speak to it critically. But it's a strange little thing. But it was an interesting attempt to do something like deeper and more meaningful, and like with like difficult subject matter. And I think games can handle that stuff. And I've certainly played more video games that have handled that stuff better. And I think board games don't, haven't really gone there as much. Like, yeah, we've got like board games and games that simulate sort of conflicts and that kind of thing that are controversial in and of themselves. But yeah, I think board games in general haven't really ever gone there very much in terms of like theme and like the actual sort of subject matters they tackle. I think it's happening more now, maybe, as the hobby matures. But I can't think of many off the top of my head, put it that way.
Leaving aside its metaphorical implications, what do we actually think of the game itself with the benefit of, like, you know, 15 years hindsight, and you have a lot of plays under your belt, Nate?
Yeah, like I said, there was a stretch there where I would have called Battlestar Galactica my favorite game. It was eventually was supplanted by Cosmic Encounter, which is still number one for me. I mean, I played this every chance I got, and that's not an exaggeration. Like, I would, every game night I'd bring it, and more often than not, I could get it played. I would have people over to my house to play it. This is, of course, in the days before my wife and I had kids. My wife played it with me, which is rare for her to find a 3-hour kind of complex game that she was into, but she watched the show. She really connected with it. One of the things about the show that was really captured in the game, not just the themes and the emotions, I talked about that, but the characters were. And they did a really neat trick where they gave each character three different basically attributes, aside from what cards they draw, but they would give them an action that only they can take on their turn. It's just a special thing they can do. Then they gave them like a special once per game action that they could do. And then you got a negative thing that your character could, that was your character was hampered with. And so that was so interesting because they did a really good job at capturing the characters. And this was true. I thought so. I see Ian, you can't see at home, but Ian is kind of not so sure. These were really well considered, I think, broadly. And I think a lot of people really connected with them. It especially was really good if you had only watched like the first season or two of the show, because a lot of the characters had kind of shifted by the time you get to the end of the show. But that was, you just, like, if you had seen the show, you just immediately saw it. You're like, oh yeah, that makes sense for Gaius Baltar or for Saltai. Those were my two favorites to play. I was like those guys, and
definitely
a Cylon. The great thing is those negative ones always were the kind of thing that was designed to throw suspicion on you. And one of the things I believe Ian touched on this, but halfway through you're dealt a second loyalty card, you might become a Cylon as the game goes on, or in the fiction of the game you discover you are. And some for example, Gaius Baltar, who, if you've seen the show, he's a really shifty guy, and in when he's dealt a second loyalty card, he's dealt two more loyalty cards. And so that's just an extra little bit of suspicion that gets thrown on him. So there's full of these little things like that. A couple things kind of sank it for me originally at the time. And the first one was, is that the show just fell out of the consciousness. It used to be like when I first started playing, people would be like, if they hadn't seen the show before, it was pretty easy to get to it. It was still airing for a little while. You could get DVDs easily. Within the next 5 years or so, at that point, if you wanted to watch the show, it wasn't airing anymore. Like, other people had moved on to other stuff. So it just was out of the zeitgeist at that point, and it just wasn't as enjoyable to play it with people who just weren't super into the show, honestly. For me, that was my experience. The second thing that happened was that the expansions were, they were all a little wonky, and I know I'm the only one who played them here, and I only played the first two, and it's been so long since I've dealt with them, honestly. But they added a lot of stuff that, this has often been an issue with Fantasy Flight expansions. They make big expansions, but sometimes they will kind of bolt a subsystem onto the side of the game that just doesn't, it's not, it maybe is interesting and maybe flows okay, but it's not really well integrated into the rest of the design.
And
the first two expansions really had that. And in a couple cases, they had things that looked really good initially. So in the second expansion, which was the Exodus expansion, they had something called the Cylon Fleet Board. So the way the Cylon Fleet would come out originally is you'd have a card, you'd flip the card, and it would put ships on the board. The Cylons appeared. Ah, there's ships on the board. Really clean, really easy, but pretty streaky too. Sometimes a couple of them would come in a row. You'd just have this pile of enemy ships on the board, and you're like scrambling to take care of it. Well, the Cylon Fleet Board was this whole process where they would like come, and I could not begin to describe it mechanically, but the upshot was that they would kind of come out in a much more balanced, even way, which was you didn't have this really sharp edge that the game had before, but it was more complicated. It bogged down the game. There's more rules to remember now, and it was not as interesting because it wasn't as dynamic. You wouldn't have big swings that would just happen in the game, but you'd be panicking and then have to get away. And I think finally, you know, and Matt's going to touch on this, I think, in when he talks about it, but there's a lot of random card draws. Just, you know, every cooperative game has this, right? If there's a chance element at the beginning, the game will randomly be much more difficult than it will at other times. That's really strong here. And I'm going to say something that I think is a little controversial, but has really proven true for me. I actually think it's too easy for the humans. And I say that because I think the humans, it's much easier to optimize the game as a human. Like what Matt was talking about, where he was playing in a forum and people could go back and could look through all the stuff you did. What we found after playing that many times is people who are experienced at playing humans. Now, you had to be experienced, but I always was, right? They were able to do that. They were able to know what people were doing. And I actually found there was far less mechanical cover for Cylons than what I ultimately wanted by the end. And so it was one of those games that I think by the time I had kind of gotten moved on from it, it was like I had a lot of fond memories, but every time I'd play it, I'd be like, just it's gone. Like, it's not there for me anymore. And that's kind of sad. And I'm a little sad I got rid of it, but also I wouldn't be playing it if I had, because truthfully, like, it was like I was kind of done with it by that time. So that's kind of been my experience with it. I'm really curious to hear how y'all are.
I think I've played it the most recently out of the three of us, because I played it like very, very recently within the last month or so. And I've forgotten how good a job it does of the early feel of the early TV show. So you've got I didn't really get to it in my 1 minute breakdown because I like got to the end of it without really speaking to it. But the crisis cards are the core of the game. Ran out of time. So the crisis cards are the core of the game. Like, you flip them over. Sometimes like Scion fleets appear. A lot of the time they are basically skill checks, and you all put cards into those checks, and you're trying to get a certain number from a certain color to like pass the skill check. And there's a lovely little thing called the Destiny deck, which is two of each color of card. And a card goes into skill check from the Destiny deck, which basically just muddies the waters constantly. So Cylons are trying to like make some of those things fail, and the humans are trying to make them pass. So when you fail something, there's lots of suspicion. And when you pass something, sometimes there's suspicion as well, because maybe there's some cards in there that might have made it fail, but maybe they came from the Destiny deck. And can you do that calculation? And that core mechanism is just really, really tasty. Like, it's just a really, really cool little mechanism. Like, the characters, like, some of them are good, I think, Nate. I don't think all of them were. Like, there's some really good color there, for sure. And there's some really nice stuff. But I think, like, some of them didn't quite work for me. I can't remember which ones. But not all of them, like, really sung. What else about that? Like, yeah, like I say, the difficulty can spike. Like, certainly in the game I played very recently, the first two turns, we just got swamped. Absolutely swamped. Managed to jump away eventually and like get rid of the fleet, because you basically move up a jump track and you can jump away from the fleet, and then you basically wipe the board and go again. And that feels kind of appropriate for the show, but also feels like, oh, we've lost basically in the first couple of turns because you're just absolutely swamped.
Ian, you actually reminded me of something I really love about this game, which is the flow and the pacing of it. Just the panic of like being swamped with Cylon ships, and you have a boarding party. This is a thing that can happen, a way you can lose. A boarding party gets on Galactica, and if it reaches a certain point, you'll lose the game. And just the way when you're like surrounded by ships and you jump away and the ships are left behind, that's such a like... it's just such a sense of relief that it brings to the game. And it's really great. It's a really nice mechanic, the way that ebbs and flows.
Yeah. I think the pace actually is a bit weird in the game. I think like the game kind of feels a bit long, and I don't think it's an actual length problem. I think it's like a pace problem, because you get that weird thing of deck. Like, it'd be like a lot of co-op games, like when if they're deck based like that, sometimes they're like, you like when you set the deck up at the start, you like sort of pace stuff through the deck, that kind of thing. I don't know if that would make that feel better, but there can be some weird pacing issues where you've got like all this panicking excitement, and then like sort of a period of like almost nothing happening apart from skill checks. And then you sort of jump again, and then more silent stuff comes out. And the pacing's just a bit weird at times. And I don't know what you can do about that. I think it's really good. And it also has one of the things I don't like about games with trade mechanics in them is when that's the only thing that's in them. So I'm not a great fan of Blood in the Clock Tower. I've only played it once, but I wasn't a great fan. And games like that, where basically the traitor mechanic is the be all and end all of the game, is just like find the traitor, identify the traitors, or be the good guys. I much prefer like folded into something. So like Tortuga is one of my other favorites. I've played quite a bit of Tortuga. That's really good, and it feels really good in Battlestar Galactica. Like that sort of like trying to hunt down the Cylons, and you can throw them in the brig and things like that. There's some cool thematic things come out of that. You know, you can throw suspects in the brig. Maybe you've just thrown the president in the brig. But the president's not actually human, that kind of thing. And in the game I played recently, I made what I later found out was a Cylon player. I made the Cylon player the de facto vice president. And then I lost the presidency and I tried to vote myself president, but I couldn't because he was a vice president. So you could only vote for the vice president, which was cool. I was just like, oh no, I've absolutely screwed myself. So yeah, there's some cool thematic stuff comes out of it.
Ian just lent usefully into my favourite thing about the game, which I think you've hit the nail on the head there, saying that in so many hidden traitor games, that is the be-all and end-all of the game. And I describe them as being cheap. They're cheap games, often both literally, they're quick games, they're not expensive games, they're games you play for 20 minutes, you ferret out the traitor, maybe you play it again, maybe you play it a couple of times, but that's the be-all and end-all of them. And I kind of like games like that. I've always liked games like that, but they always felt they were missing something. Like Saboteur's a good example. Used to play where you know you're putting cards down trying to make a mine to reach a gem, but somebody's a saboteur, and so they're putting in the wrong cards left, right, and center. But it's quick. It's normally pretty easy to spot who the saboteurs are, and they don't have enough of a swing on the game to stop people getting to the gems. But the thing about Battlestar Galactica is that it makes everything into a really interrelated, complex package of stuff that's going on. So you've got this whole structure, this skill-based structure on the one hand, you have the skill checks and the fleet board on the other hand, all of which leans in to the fact there's a hidden traitor, because you could be putting the wrong cards down into that skill check. You could be manoeuvring civilian ships into the jaws of the Cylon fleet, and there's always plausible deniability for doing both things. Or for doing any bad thing, almost pretty much in Battlestar Galactica, and so you've got this package which is the hidden traitor mechanics supports the mechanical mechanics if your game is like, and yet the mechanical mechanics also support a narrative because they're thematic, as you mentioned, and yet they also support this Kalos style ferreting out of analysis of skill cards and moves, and it's just all the parts support all the others like a gorgeous sculpted kind of like curved architectural edifice that's just a delight in that respect. It's really, really nice. I haven't had that experience that you've had, Nate, of kind of like burning out on it, although I think I began to see that when I played it by Forum, that it's like this is a thing. I don't think I'd ever describe it as being biased in favour of the humans, but you began to see what levers to press.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the funny thing is, it's interesting how you said your favourite characters are like Galtus. Galtus?
Gaius Baltar.
Galtus, that's it. You see, I haven't
changed. Gaius Baltar and Saltai are my two favourites.
That's right. But the guy with gets the two loyalty cards is always popular. Every game you play, somebody chooses that character. And it's because everybody wants to be a Cylon.
Yep.
Even though it's kind of like seen as being in some respects a weaker side when people know the game, it's just much more fun. I find it quite stressful being a Cylon. I've only done it a couple of times, but knowing when to pull the rug, you know, and when to try and but it's also that much more engaging, and it's kind of really funny how people want to play the bad guys. I'm going to tell a story which I find really really interesting on a whole number of levels. I played a game of this once with some friends of mine. It was on New Year's Eve, actually, funnily enough. We paused the game to sing Auld Lang Syne and top up our drinks. And there were two or three, I think it was three, maybe two teenagers playing. And they were, when I say teenagers, they were young teens, like 13, 14, something like that. And yeah, it must have been two, because it's a five-player game, isn't it, with that expansions?
It goes up to six.
Okay, there may have been three. Right, it doesn't matter anyway. But yeah. Two of them, we thought, were silent. And it's like, and we started messing around and considering putting them in the brig, trying to exclude them from manoeuvring ships around and or doing all the stuff for the fleet that might have helped us. And it came to a very tense end game, but the humans eventually lost. And when people were flipping their character cards over, or their loyalty cards, we were fully expecting these two teenagers just to flip over and sign on. And they weren't. They were both human. And the other of three human, there was just this moment of stunned outrage. Total, so it's like, you've totally torpedoed this four-hour game on New Year's Eve. Did you understand what the rules meant? Did you, like, read the rules properly? You yanking my chain? And they were just like, no, we just thought it'd be fun. We just thought it'd be funny, to, you know, because it sounded more fun to be a Cylon than to be a human. And it initially, that anger very quickly faded. It's like, well, hang on a minute. I just had an awesome time.
Yep.
Not figuring out successfully and this really exciting endgame who the Cylons were. And it really, I think, made me reconsider. I don't have any like great answers for this, no great theories, but it makes you reconsider this idea. There's this thing that you're always supposed to play a game to the best of your ability. Otherwise, it spoils it for everybody else. If you don't play a game to the best of your ability, then you're kind of ruining it for the other players. You're not being respectful to the other players. But that's not always true, I don't think. There are times when the drama of a game, the dramatic demands of a game, yeah, override its kind of like mechanical... I don't know, impetus, I suppose. I mean, do you know what I mean? Is that fair, do you think? It's not common.
Yeah, and in fact, what you're saying there was a guy whose blog I used to read a lot. I haven't for a while, but his name is, I think, Brian Bankler, and he wrote a blog called The Tao of Gaming. And have you read his stuff before? He does some good analysis, especially on heavier Euro style. And this game, this was in his rotation a lot around 2008, 2009, like it was for many of us. And he was not the target demographic in terms of game style for this sort of game. But one of the things he wrote, he just would write entry after entry talking about session reports and just his analysis of the game. And one of the things he said was, and it stuck with me, and I think it actually changed the way I look at games. It was that profound. It was... but what he wrote was the enjoyment of the experience trumps any mechanical issues I have. And I think that was the first time I'd really heard someone express that in at least in a way that I understood. Like I'd heard people say like, the mechanics aren't that important, but if the experience is good, and it turns out that I actually am a much more experiential gamer than I thought I was. And Battlestar Galactica was a game that helped me realize that. I actually thought of one other issue I have with the game, and this is one I think we can all agree with, is the game is kind of fragile in how the best experience can be. It really should be just a five-player game.
Yeah.
Don't play it with three. It's like playing Dune with three. Don't do that to yourself. You can play with four or six, but the problem at four or six is that you have this mechanic called the Cylon Leader, quote-unquote, who's sort of like Schrodinger's Cylon. Like he becomes a Cylon based on how good the humans are doing. And it's just, it's a very gamey balancing mechanic kind of thing. The game feels, it sings with five people.
Yeah.
The other thing is it sings with people who are all pretty experienced with it. The worst experiences are when the poor new person has to be the Cylon and the experienced players are all humans. And that human is, the humans are just going to steamroll them. Usually, like that was always my experience. And the person is like, I don't know what to do. And that became more and more common the further on I went with the game. That's not really the game's fault. That's just an issue of experience and the kind of game it is. But that fragility is just kind of always there. And that there was a lot of people on Board Game Geek trying to figure out a variant to get around it. And I think that the variant was just play with five people.
One other thing I have to mention, actually, just as a humour value as much as anything else, is after the first time I ever played Battlestar Galactica, we introduced a house rule, which I have used faithfully ever since, which is that when you get your like loyalty card, you pick it up and you have to stare at it for a full 30 seconds before you put it down.
We do that as well.
Why that wasn't in the rule book, I don't know. Because for those who haven't played it, the human loyalty cards are essentially blank. They're just a human. The traitor ones, the silent ones, are full of text.
They have a special power on
them.
Last
time we played it, everybody picked up their cards and everybody put them straight out again, except for the Cylons, who were still going, wait. So we had to deal again. But there we go. Just to fly back to what Nate was mentioning there about balance issues, I was going to mention something that in another game of this I played, and it kind of, you know, it relates to what we're talking about here, which is that you talk about balance issues. I played in a game where we had every single Cylon attack card before the halfway point of the game. And that's not halfway point of the deck, because the deck is normally longer than the game. Every single one came out before we hit the halfway jump point. And it was just, I mean, it was just murder out there. It really was. It was impossible. Whole place constantly swarming with Cylons, and I don't think we even managed to jump to leave them behind. But going back to what you were saying about experiential games, despite that, it's still a story I'm here telling you on a podcast, mm-hmm. because it was great fun and memorable and exciting, even though it was obviously a lost cause. And that's the kind of game that Battlestar Galactica is, I guess, and that is what makes it exciting and still worth looking at.
So am I allowed to share one more war story of this game before we move on?
Yeah, because they're fun. Yes.
Okay. The only time I ever truly lost my temper at a game was during a game of Battlestar Galactica. And it happened because I was kind of, you know, this is probably, you probably experience this if you're the person who owns the games. You're often kind of serving as a soft game master. You're kind of the person who's kind of running it and helping people. Well, two of the people I was playing with, they, you know, we're all friends. We knew each other. They were starting to really bicker in a way that was making me kind of anxious. And they would not let up. And I eventually kind of stood up and said, you guys need to stop it or we cannot play anymore. Like it got me that anxious. And afterward, the host of the game night came to me and said, like, hey man, you cannot lose your temper like that again. And I was like, oh, I was so ashamed. And then I was telling him about it the next day and they said, oh, we knew how pissed off you were. We were just doing it for the game. We were like seeing who could bluff the other one to crack. And I was like, are you joking me? Like I got a talking to and you're the ones. Oh man. I was so angry. They might listen to this and they'll know their shame. They'll know who they are.
Ugh. Disgraceful.
Well, I'm quite happy to open the floor to more stories because it's Ian that has to edit this, even though I'm hosting it. So get him in while he's
right. Right.
So moving on then. It is time to save Ian the gigabyteage on his hard drive. Obviously been a long time now since Battlestar Galactica was released, and as Nate has alluded to, its star has faded to some degree, although not entirely. We'll come to that in a minute, no doubt. How do we feel it's influenced games that came after it up until the present day?
I mean, it's still talked about with some reverence, right? It's still well-regarded, still seen as a great game. I mean, did one thing I was wondering is, like, did it sort of bring that traitor mechanism to a wider audience? There were games that came after it, certainly. I think like Dead of Winter was one that Matt mentioned in our show notes, and one I'd totally forgotten about. But yeah, I played Dead of Winter as well, and I'm sure there must have been others after Battlestar Galactica, because it was so popular. There must have been other folk that jumped on that bandwagon. And there's been certainly of recent, there's been a lot of more hidden traitor games coming out. I mean, like I mentioned Blood in the Clock Tower earlier. That's had a big influence in the last sort of couple of years. I mean, that's still around.
Yeah, I mean, I think this was, I think it kind of created it as, you know, we talked about Agricola last year and Pandemic, his games that sort of, they weren't the originators of worker placement and cooperative games respectively, but they were sort of the codifiers. And after that, you can kind of look at most games that came out in that genre as kind of being in conversation with those ones. And I do think Battlestar Galactica has that kind of quality. I think in some ways it was kind of, there was sort of a tacit admission you couldn't top that experience in that scale of a game. And so a lot of stuff tried to kind of break it down into a smaller, more constrained experience, one that was not licensed. So there would not be a license to lose, which is ultimately what happened with Fantasy Flight. So stuff like Dark Moon, things like that. I actually think where it ended up being the most obvious was in shorter games. Stuff like Blood in the Clock Tower, One Night Ultimate Werewolf, which is actually a game I think is pretty fun. I like that one a lot. The biggest one to me is The Resistance and The Resistance Avalon, which are, I actually think, for a small 15-20 minute trader game, which I think you guys are exactly right. It's really easy for people to under-design those. They don't have a lot of grit to them. It's just whoever you're in a bad mood at that day that person's a traitor. But yeah. The Resistance actually has some of that back and forth, and it's sort of just like it's not exactly like the skill checks in Battlestar Galactica, but it has a similar kind of mechanic, and it's, you can kind of look on it as like it's just a game of skill checks and suspicion, which is, it's a lesser game than Battlestar Galactica, but I think it's sort of, I think as people got tired of the length and as the zeitgeist kind of ended, the license wasn't really resonating with people, I think they gravitated towards smaller stuff like that.
See, that's interesting because I've always seen The Resistance as being in the cheap category that I mentioned earlier. Yes, better than some of those games, as you say, but it's still, it's just not in the same ballpark as Battlestar Galactica.
No, well, yeah, obviously.
It's a quick throwaway thing. Yeah, and I think that, you know, I think Ian had more of it when you're saying that what it inspired, games came after it. There were a flurry of games that came after it. Dead of Winter was the most obvious one. And Mansions of Madness 2nd Edition. Possibly.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah,
that's true. Has some links to it. There were a few that came out, but I remember playing both of those games, both Dead of Winter and Mansions of Madness 2nd Edition, and thinking at the time, well, these are fun. They're not as good as Battlestar Galactica. And this is the problem. This is what it has. So yeah, it did bring sort of like, it came of age with hidden role games, but it's really only recently that we've kind of got anywhere near that. The game, I wouldn't say it surpasses it, but the only game I could think of that kind of is in that ballpark of for the modern era is Nemesis and Nemesis Lockdown. You played those?
No,
I have not played that.
They're the alien rip-offs, your aliens rip-offs, where you're trying to crew escaping from a space station or ship while xenomorph monsters are spawning around you. And you all have, maybe traitors too, it's too strong a word, but you have hidden goals in it. Sure. And the hidden goals, sometimes they're cooperative, sometimes they are directly competitive and see you wanting to eliminate one or more other players. And so... But that's a long time. I mean, these are pretty recent games, Lockdown. And the thing about Lockdown is that it's much more complex, even than Battlestar Galactica. It did my head in, frankly, the amount of different subsystems it had in it and ultimately led to me moving on. So, but one thing we haven't talked about, the thing we have to talk about here is Unfathomable, which is why I say, you know, it may have, its eclipse has gone, Battlestar Galactica, but yet it still has this reskin, this Unfathomable reskin, which I think, I haven't played it. Either you guys played it?
I have a friend who played it, who I played the Battlestar Galactica with recently, and he said it wasn't quite as good, and like it removes some bits and pieces, like more smooths things out a little bit. Maybe it's a little less spiky, but I think the spikiness in Battlestar Galactica is half of the point, almost, like that it's sort of weird and kind of spiky and a bit edgy. So it's like, I think it smooths things out a little bit. I haven't played it. I had a bit of a problem with Unfathomable because it's got that weird sort of like fear of others thing kind of at the core of it, which is like definitely the bad and not nice side of Lovecraft work, for sure.
Well, it's not going as far into that bad side of Lovecraft as it could.
No, absolutely.
Obviously not. No, I was thinking about this before we recorded it. It's like, you know, there's no fingers need to be pointed here. You know, it is not inherently any kind of objectionable game, Unfathomable, which I should mention is, you know, it's a reskin. I was asking you, Ian, about, or anyone who's played it, because I thought it was a very close reskin. Obviously, they've changed a bit more about it than I realised.
Yeah, just a little bit of smoothing off, I think. Not like a lot, but just smooth things off a little bit.
It casts the traitors as like fishmen, you know, cultists, deep one cultists from Lovecraft. Yeah,
the Innsmouth look.
Universe.
Yeah.
The Innsmouth look, that's right. And none of that is played up in the game, to my knowledge. So the game itself is not objectionable in any way, shape, or form. I'm not pointing fingers here, but it opens a gateway for people who want to trade on the underlying objectionableness that is there in Lovecraft's idea. for that story, which was his fear of the other, of the alien, of the, you know, that fear, you know, is in Lovecraft's work is blatantly racist. And Unfathomable is certainly not. I'm not pointing fingers, but it gives succor, I suppose, to people who want to see it that way, if that makes sense.
I would really like to play Unfathomable. And in fact, if I don't have a steady group of, like, say, five people that I could play with regularly, or I would have already gotten a copy probably. But one of the things I just feel like you would lose in it is some of those thematic overtones of politics and the kind of the darker corners of the game. Like, what, you know, and we're still dealing with this now, right? Like, how much power are you willing to give to the powerful to be kept safe? Yeah. And are those people actually trustworthy and stuff like that? And I think, well, the suspicion of a ship, I mean, at that point, it's more like John Carpenter's The Thing, which admittedly is an awesome movie and a great inspiration. And they've made games based on that, too. But it's not nearly as, I think, universal and profound to me as the more kind of broadly political questions being asked. But that's not really the game's fault. I don't want to ding it for that. Because, you know, again, like Fantasy Flight has this great design that's really effective. I mean, and they can't use the license anymore. So this is how it's got to be. And that's fine. I actually think that in 20 years, we'll look on Battlestar Galactica as the new Dune. Now that Dune has been reprinted. But the same kind of thing, right? I mean, a kind of singular game that's, you couldn't really be recreated in another. That's very tied to its theme. Yeah. But it's a theme that's licensed. Yeah. And is kind of hard to get a hold of now. And it's really only been since the movies of Dune have been made that the games, you know, now we have more Dune games than we know what to do with. But for a good 30 years, we didn't. And I think Battlestar Galactica is going to be in that realm. So in 20 years, you see it in a math trade for 100, you know, or you can get it for $150 or something like that. It's already that kind of game, really. So it's going to have that kind of legend surrounding it, I think.
Yeah.
I would say discussion for other time. It's a better game than Dune as well. Controversial, but
it's controversial.
Yeah, so we plan on Dune at some point. Let's not go there. So the whole point of this podcast is to re-examine older games in the light of the modern lens, the light of the modern era. So bearing in mind, looking back on it with the benefit of hindsight, would you still recommend that people play it now today?
I think it's still a great game. I mean, I've played again recently. I think it was a lot better than I remembered, actually, playing it again. It's still very good. I can't really in good conscience like fully recommend it because it's relatively expensive to get, and it's hard to get because you can only really get it secondhand. There, like Matt mentioned, there were some forum ways to play it, and we'll put links to those in the show notes. But like, yeah, if you want a physical copy, you are going to have to like track it down and pay over the odds for sure, unfortunately. So I don't think I could good conscience recommend it, but it is very good. If you can play it and a friend's got a copy, give it a shot, definitely. Should you seek it down and absolutely play it? You could play Unfathomable. It's probably pretty close. I haven't played it yet. There are other sort of trading mechanic games out there. Like Nate says, it really plays best only at five. So do you have a group of five you can play it with on a regular basis? All these caveats in there. Yeah.
This is my controversial statement for the night. I think it's almost never worth it to track down a very expensive out-of-print game. It's just like for the amount of effort and money you often have to pay for games like that, and then like how much you'll actually play them. Cause a lot of times games go out of print when they're kind of weird and long. And this is a little bit in that category.
Definitely, yeah. It's weird and long.
Here's what you should do. You should play your friend's copy. If you have a buddy who has a copy, absolutely say, hey, I want to try that out. I've always been curious about it. If you want to buy a copy, I mean, hey, maybe you'll get lucky and see it in a math trade, but I would not plunk down, you know, a couple $100 to get a copy. You can buy a lot of good games for that amount of money that you'll probably play more. But it is great. It's a terrific experience. And I actually do think I've not played Unfathomable, but I actually think a reskinned version, it probably still really fits with the atmosphere of it pretty well. Go for it. I actually think that would be the way to go.
I'm gonna sign a slightly different note here because I don't know what it's like in America, right? But I looked at this before the show, and copies of Battlestar Galactica shift in this country for round about £100, round about three figures, I think.
That's pretty good.
Fairly average. Unfathomable will cost you £70 new.
Yeah.
So this idea that it's somehow out of reach, that it, you know, people forget, I think, sometimes just how nuts expensive board games have become. You know, they really ain't cheap things anymore. And when you make that comparison, £30 for a better theme, better mechanics,
yeah,
less Lovecraft racism, I think is worth it. Because I still think, as I alluded to before, I don't think this has been bettered in terms of hidden trace games. Yeah, you need 5. Yeah, you need 4 hours to play it. But as an experience, in terms of that supporting, self-supporting structure, integrated structure I was talking about, nothing has beaten this yet, I don't think. Every little thing in the game supports every little thing, and it's just such a delightfully whole package that I reckon you owe it to yourself not to spend £100. You know, this, we're in a cost of living crisis, for God's sake. You know, that's a lot of money. But as I say, the alternatives are also a lot of money. And if you can play it by forum, as we've mentioned. Yeah, I would give it a game if you haven't tried it so far. It hasn't really been bettered. It's still really good, and it still has political lessons to learn from it. They may not be the ones that it started with, but that's the beauty of great art, isn't it? Is that the lessons you draw from it change with the time in which you play it. And I think there's a whole new set of lessons here for a new generation to pick up on.
And it's the first sort of big game by a now very well known designer. So if you're sort of interested in the history of designers and board games, it's a good one to play for sure.
Yeah,
it's easier to find than a copy of StarCraft, probably.
I think I've got a friend with a copy of StarCraft as well.
So do I.
Okay, well, let's not sit around here gawping about it. Let's go and play them.
Indeed.
Bye, everyone.
Bye for now.
Bye.
Thanks very much for listening. Editing for the cast was done by me, Ian McAllister. The music for the cast was provided by my brother-in-law, David Dolliver, with my friend, Alistair McLeod. Our logo was created by Rachel Wines-Thrower. If you like what you've listened to, then the best way to help us out is by telling your friends about us and leave us a review and rating on your podcast host of choice. You can follow the hosts on various social media platforms, and we'll put links to all of those in our show notes. You can come and chat to the team and fellow game enthusiasts in our Discord, and if you'd like to support us financially, you can do so through our Patreon. Links to both of those will be in the show notes as well. If you'd like to contact us about any of the games we've covered on the cast, should cover, or anything else really, you can contact us at cultoftheolduk@gmail.com. Bye for now.